Hello guys, and welcome to another episode of Korea Startup Podcast. Have you ever wondered how is innovation driven inside a big corporate? Well, this is an aspect that is starting to become more important for them, as many startups are growing and competing. In this episode, we invited Dmitry Bastianov. He has been working in the innovation department of Santander Bank in the UK for several years, and he has experienced many different types of approaches to foster the innovation internally. In this episode, we are going to understand how this department works and especially which are the best practices to foster the innovation. On top of that, Dmitry is going to share how different it would have been for him to build the exact product outside Santander as a startup in terms of speed, access to capital, autonomy, and the benefits and disadvantages for the entrepreneur. I really hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to the 13th episode of Korea Startup Podcast. Today we are with our co-host Laida.
Hello.
And with Dima Bastianov. Hello, Dima.
Hello.
So today we are going to talk about entrepreneurship. We have Dima here that have been talking as a product manager in the Santander Bank. He comes from a really small town in Russia, in the middle of nowhere. Then he moved to the UK to study, and now he's here in Korea. So maybe we're going to start introducing a bit yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit it like spot on. So definitely coming from a town in the middle of nowhere where I lived for about 17 years doing my schooling. And then I decided, hey, I'm destined for greater things, which I don't know if I am, but, you know, just got to try it out. So that's how I moved to London. I studied at University College London, got into entrepreneurship and I guess the local startup scene. Even did a tech community there called London New Tech, so managed to grow it to about 15,000 members before I left. And that kind of, I guess, gave me the confidence to pursue my own thing. So I did a startup with a co-founder, a friend, actually, in my last year of uni. That unfortunately failed, so we sort of worked on it for about a year, like 6 months maybe, full-time after graduation. It didn't work out for a few reasons. Like, we just didn't know how to do B2B sales properly. But anyway, that eventually led me to my next opportunity, which was at Santander UK. The whole story how I got there, but once I joined, just never really looked back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where does it come, your interest or passion for the business world and especially the startup scene?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I just want to say my dad. So he pretty much lived through the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he was one of the few people who realized, like, okay, I need to provide for my family. So he joined a small business as a manager. He graduated in marketing and then kind of did that for a bit, learned the ropes and decided to buy out the company. And there was the whole saga of, like, how he had to deal with like the organized crime at that point, because those guys like wanted some of the profits. Yeah. And he kind of had to really stand up. But like, long story short, is such an inspiring figure for me. And seeing how much he did for my family, because when I was young, we were still a working class family pretty much. And by the time I was in my high school, we were like middle class, upper middle class. And the fact that I was able to study in one of the top universities in the UK, whereas a lot of my peers could not, made me feel, well, for one, pride for kind of my dad and what he did for my family, but also wanting to do better for other people. Hmm. And I think that's kind of what moved me into entrepreneurship and seeing this as a like powerful vehicle, not just kind of for economies to grow, but also for families kind of, to experience a better life, simple as it sounds.
And you have been these past years working in the innovation department inside Santander, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there you have developed some projects, and you have more or less like the idea on how the differences between entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship works. So I would like to ask you, how is the innovation department inside this big corporate? How do they work?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, to answer that question, I think it would be kind of useful to go back in time slightly. So I joined Santander in 2019 and left in 2022, so good 3 years. But before that, the kind of the history of the innovation team started in 2015. And at that time, the head of the innovation was reporting directly to the CEO. So there was this almost like a unanimous buy-in from the senior leadership. We need to do innovation. Reason why, the fintechs were really blowing up. So it was 2015, which means like that's by the that around that time they were hitting $1 billion valuations, and everybody in the big banks like was just losing their heads. Can I swear on this?
Yeah.
Okay, like losing their shit, quite simply. And I think that's when they're like, okay, we need to do something better. Innovation is at the core of our agenda. So there is this person called Sigur. So she's from Iceland, a very impressive woman, like with very impressive track record. So her remit was, she had about, I think her remit was, can you go out, find early stage fintechs to collaborate with and create, co-create a product with? So, and for that, she had a budget of a few, like tens of millions of pounds. So,
okay,
just talking about magnitudes here. And I think, so she had that remit for about like a year and a half, just, you know, to try it out. Basically, everybody who worked at the innovation team, their main purpose was to find those startups, like screen them, make sure they're the right fit to work with Santander. And once all the boxes were ticked, there would be that person liaising the creation of what we call proof of concept, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a simple project you do with another company just to prove to senior executives that this collaboration will work and you need to invest more money. So, and it worked pretty well on the kind of execution side. You know, the startups were quite keen because there were still, some of them were still early stage. They wanted that, you know, the big bang to come in and kind of increase their valuation. Mm. Well, yeah. That would be the story they'll be telling to their investors. And in a way, like the bank, you know, would have a small startup that is very nimble and can do and pivot, can do innovation and pivot quite quickly to do a lot of the legwork. So, but what actually ended up happening was very different. once the first period of like meetings with the executive committee started, and they presented the first proof of concepts with those companies, there was just this amazing like, yeah, this looks great, but how do we integrate this with our legacy systems? Mm. And silence. Like that. and no one really wanted to own up and like and say, yeah, you know, my team will integrate this into our Santander kind of infrastructure. So, and in fact, you were basically left with this, there is this team that creates amazing proof of concept, but then there is nobody in the what we call business as usual team that wants to integrate them. So you just went ahead, spent a lot of money, and no one really wants to use it within the bank. Uh-huh. Weird. So like, okay, this is not really working out. How about we take a few of our people, a few maybe people from the startup world, and create a what they call a speedboat. So that's a corporate spin out, i.e. and a startup that was created by some people in the corporate, but operates under a different name. And then you kind of agree that ownership structure between the company and the kind of the founders, i.e. the people running the company. And that didn't work out. And the company, so the one that I think people from her team did was called Asto. And it was a fintech that helped small, medium businesses do invoicing and expense management. Mm-hmm. And the way that it monetizes is through cash flow loans.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, they get that data, mm-hmm. and then they kind of like embedded finance, you know, hey, how about you take this loan? Because I know you need money. And that one actually, I think there was some sort of excitement from the customers, like seemed like there were signs of early product market fit just at the testing stage. And I think, yeah, in a way, everybody was bought in. There was this sense of like almost, hey, let's open up bottles of champagne. And Santander, I think overall invested like tens of millions of pounds in this thing. But what ended up happening was internally was what I would call a political shit show. I was told I can't swear. But anyway, so basically you had what's supposed to be a startup run by corporate people that care about hierarchies, that care about titles. So when you try, when you try and marry, I guess, the agility of us, of the startup with the corporate world, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You need operators, you need people with entrepreneurial experience who know how to basically do things fast and not manage stakeholders, if I put it very simply. Mm-hmm. So after those two big things didn't really work out, and it was a bit of a failure, I guess, kind of for the innovation team. I don't know if CEO changed or just the overall direction or the priority of the bank changed, but basically then a new person, Sigur left, and the new person kind of took the role, became the director of innovation, and that would be director of when I came in, so around 2019, Stephen Jury, which, you know, to his credit, he was given a very not the easiest of tasks to deal with in a situation where the reputation of the innovation team kind of really went down, and because of that and the priorities change, he was only given around £200,000 of budget.
200,000
Exactly.
Oh my god!
Like in the
what do they do with 200,000?
That's the thing. I think he was given an impossible task, to be honest. And at that time, I joined, and of course, I was pitched this as a, hey, you're going to come in and do startups for corporate money. I was like, of course, yeah, sign me up, right? Uh-huh. But then I joined, and it's actually quite different. Mm-hmm. And that was almost in response to that earlier problem where, you know, there were people in the bank who didn't want to integrate the outside technology. So his take, or like I guess Stephen's angle, was that how about we try and have this team of kind of innovation partners that go out as innovation consultants to different teams like mortgages team or the wealth management team, mm-hmm. and help them create ideas and kind of and add to their product backlog. And usually how those business as usual teams work is that Santander is a public company, quite simply. They are very much driven by the kind of the next quarter, right? And they always kind of operate in this yearly cycle where they don't really look beyond that. So and the idea or the angle was that innovation team would come in and create a pipeline of ideas for them to work on something that would be relevant in 2 years' time, you know, in 3 years, etc. So kind of more long term. And I think it kind of made sense. And with the money we were given, that would only allow us to do very light validation work. And when I say validation, it means if you have an idea, how do you tell if it works, right? You would do some sort of kind of user testing, or i.e. interviewing potential customers, or you do a survey to a large group of people, or you would do a landing page test or paid advertising test just to see if the concept even catches on. So that's what I mean. And for that, you don't need much money. And that's probably what those £200,000 were really for, or the only thing you could use it for. So long story short, that's what I did for maybe like a year upon joining. And, you know, as a new joiner, I just had so much energy and I wanted to kind of really bring it. But what ended up happening was me going around a few teams doing innovation, like, well, we call them design thinking workshops.
Okay.
Around the team, and everybody like, yeah, this sounds great, you know, but we have other priorities. And that would usually work out. We have a workshop, maybe a few of those. We'd have a portfolio of ideas that, you know, we could invest and work into. They're like, okay, awesome, you know, do more work. We would then validate it, you know, do some early stage validation, estimate the market opportunity, and effectively put it in a nice deck, you know, to present to the directors. And they would just sit down like, this sounds great, but actually we have this another priority that, you know, that is very pressing that we'll reach out later on. And which basically means yes, but no, mm-hmm. in a very British and way, because mm-hmm. people are not comfortable telling you no. They just say not today.
Later.
Exactly.
And why do you think that's happening?
Oh, that's just their priorities do not align. Like, they are always judged, by how much more mortgages they sell, how many more customers get an investment product. So it's a very different set of KPIs than what we kind of thinking about, right? We're thinking, well, is there an opportunity with large enough total addressable market, which we're not even considering? How do we approach that? And that's a very different lens to look at opportunities, at how you decide what you do. And that would be probably one of the bigger reasons, but I'm sure there are, like, if we dive deeper, I can kind of elaborate there a bit more on, what matters to a business as usual team versus what matters to an innovation team. But where was I in my story? Oh, yeah. So, of course, that wasn't working out after about a year, and I was growing very frustrated. And I wasn't the only one. So around my time, we also had three other new joiners. So Maria, who's been with the bank for some time, she had an MBA, really cool woman, like Maria Costa, check her out. plugs. Dean Fankhauser, a serial entrepreneur. So he actually had an exit under his belt. He sold his startup Nuji, e-commerce startup Nuji, to Klarna, which is a big player in Europe. And Diana Wong. So she is a UX researcher. She worked both at an agency level and kind of did a few startups on her own as well. So we were like this very colorful, very diverse bunch. And we were not really happy with what's happening. It seemed like we had no budget or no control to actually do product development. Like, you know, we could do everything before that, like idea generation, validation, blah, 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 but not really everything that the interesting bit, which is the product development. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening, we were like, hey, we're a bunch of smart people, and what can we do to change things? Because this is not working out. Like, us basically going around these teams and pretty much telling them that, well, we think we're giving them a favor, but they don't really value that. Mm-hmm. Around that time, actually, I found out that there is a global innovation team. Haha, mm-hmm. What a twist. turns out there is a UK innovation team, and then, so every country that Santander has presence in apparently has their own innovation team. Okay. And there's a global innovation team, like Umbrella, which kind of tries to make sure that all of them work together somehow. And the cool thing is that they have their own budget, and like we're talking like millions, if not hundreds of millions, of dollars or euros. No, don't know, but anyway.
now it's the same, basically.
So. Yeah, now it's the same, exactly. And the cool thing, so they have that money and they have nowhere to deploy it, really. I think it's meant to be a budget for like acquisitions or maybe, you know, to finance projects within specific countries. And we just approached them we have, and I think Dean Fankhauser has been a big driving force in this, as well as Gary Massey, my manager. So he would be actually a proper example of an entrepreneur because he's done multiple projects within the bank. And unfortunately, a lot of them didn't see the light of day, but that's just mismanagement by Santander. I said it, Gary. Money monsters. Always remember. I can tell you more about Money Monsters. Such a great product that's been mishandled. Anyway, by Santander. Back to this. So, and Dean was, I think he really clicked with some of the people in the global innovation team, in a sense that I think some of the people at the helm were from the US, and he spoke their language. So they kind of, you know, they understood each other. They understood the world of opportunity and how you need to go about doing innovation. And so he proposed an idea. How about instead of us kind of, you know, begging all these teams, instead we will propose some speedboat ideas, but in a different way, where you don't give us tens of millions of pounds or dollars straight away, like they did with Asto. Instead, you unlock funding in trenches. So, for example, we came to you with a winning idea. You give us 500,000 or 300,000 just to develop the prototype. The prototype, basically. If that's working well, then we will give you maybe another 700 just to do the go-to-market, you know, the initial go-to-market strategy and kind of the actual execution. So seeing how it lands with, and by the way, all of that would happen, from a different brand name, like Santander is not affiliated or mentioned anywhere. So it's, and the thing is, the UK couldn't do it, but the global team could. So they had the lawyers in place to basically allow for this thing to happen. And we were just, impressed. Like, they seemed to be just the perfect sponsors for what we wanted to do. And that's basically what ended up happening. A few people in our team effectively formed this venture studios, as you know, people refer to it. And the way it works is that each week, all of us have to pitch at least one or two startup ideas. And the thesis of that venture studios is that fintech is oversaturated. By then, it would be 2020, right? So a lot of big players have already emerged. But PropTech is largely untouched. And by the way, could be a bigger opportunity than fintech or fintech combined. And we were like, hey, so this is a venture studios focused on PropTech. And that kind of how the grind started. And that actually was the most fun I've had in my job, just because of how intense it was, how stimulated my brain was, because I had to constantly seek inspiration, read stuff, and just generate tons and tons of ideas. A lot of them were shit, like let's face it. But I would always know it at a very early stage, and kind of how we designed our process is you first do an elevator pitch. Uh-huh. That thing has to be 1 or 2 minutes, like very fast, very simple. And I can tell you what the structure of it is, which is, I think in itself is like lots of value. Then if that got an okay, then you go to a deep dive stage where you're given 7 minutes. And that's when you kind of try to uncover the hidden stones, I guess, or things that can really trip up that idea. And if all of that works out, then the whole team like jumps on that idea, and then you kind of spend some time creating effectively a prototype in Figma. You know, you would do some customer testing, see if people it resonates with people, and then you would go and create a pitch deck if it all works out to the global innovation team. And you know, by then it would probably be like 80% there anyway. And that's what actually happened. So this venture studios model, I think it existed for about 4 months, maybe 5 months. And we already had one project which won funding called In-House. And it was a way for, I guess, people to do property viewings remotely. So similar to how, let's say, you know, if I were to go to a like I wanted to buy a property, I'll probably go ahead and view all those properties myself physically, which takes so much time, versus if somebody just went ahead and kind of did a stream, right? Yeah. Not even a recording, a stream.
A stream.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. So it's almost like verticalization of Zoom, if you think about it, but just for a prop tech kind of a property search application. Application, I guess. Yeah.
And was it in 2D or in like virtual reality?
No, it's 2D. Like, and that's the thing. Like, we think that we looked at the 3D, the virtual reality market, and it's largely not there. It's gimmicky and it's maybe, you know, like 5 to 10 years down the line, if Meta does well by its promise, then maybe we could you could consider it. But for now, yeah. It's like don't touch it, like dead on arrival. But yeah, I think that, and we actually had a very solid go-to-market strategy as well. So everybody was excited, and something happens to the global innovation team. They get restructured. All of a sudden, you know, everybody was almost celebrating, and I was celebrating because I was like, finally, something I've been working on will see the light of day. And because of that, so, and we already had an alpha developed. With a team which was fun. Like, the next stage would be to launch it. I was disheartened, and I think that was the moment where I actually wanted to leave. Because I was like, look, we are trying. This is the second time we're trying something, and it's just not working out. I don't think there's future for this thing, for innovation. heads on thunder. Then the interesting thing happens. So turns out that my manager, Gary Massey, from 2019, him and Steven, the director, they've been kind of doing their, as I would call it, politics. They were playing a bit of politics in the org, in a sense where Steven was, although he did not directly report to the CEO, he was actually kind of still helping him out in terms of, you know, picking up different initiatives or doing things which are technically outside of his pay or like outside of his role responsibilities. And I think all of that was to win favor, right? Mm. So that in a way, whatever then Steven says, like, will kind of not, you know, will land much, much better. And so that what actually happened. So one of the concepts that I think that Gary was working on back in 2018, 2019 maybe, was My Home Manager. And that's the product that eventually got launched. Hey! but yeah, so now back to 2019, right? And so yeah, basically my manager, Gary Massey, they've been kind of persuading and doing a lot of that in the background. They also did a proof of concept where they've created a dashboard which just pulls in a lot of data, both internal Santander data and external through APIs, just to create a dashboard about person's property and, you know, maybe things that are happening in the neighborhood. And the main point was to show that, hey, we can build something internally if we were, you know, to use modern architecture like AWS or Salesforce in a very efficient way with little money, right? So that's what we call lean product development. And everybody was really impressed, and it seemed maybe part of it because of like how much Steven has done for the CEO. But yeah, he was like, I'm cool. I'm like, I'm investing, you know, the invest button. and that's what ended up happening, right? So the POC was a success. It was effectively an internal POC. It never saw the light of day. And that's when we had enough money. I think we're talking like, I don't know, maybe 5 mils? I have no idea, to be honest, how much it was. Gary never told me. But yeah, it was enough money basically for us to create a squad, a product development squad, which consisted of about 16 people. So we're looking at 3 backend engineers, 3 front-end engineers, 3 designers, 2 UX researchers, 3 product people, including myself, and I think 1 tech lead, 1 scrum master. Maybe I've forgotten somebody. Kind of, I think that was it. And then the idea was, yes, so we finally have the budget to like really go and build this thing. And what this thing is, sorry, I kept you guys waiting. so it's an app for homeowners to take, to access all sorts of home services, or how we like to call it in the business world, it's a curated marketplace. So the idea in a nutshell is we have customers, lots of people that take mortgages with us, and there are all these amazing home services like ordering a tradesperson or getting help with home moving that they might not necessarily know about. And so the idea is, yeah, we will just create this app which pulls all the services in together and see what happens. And of course, there's a lot of thought that went into it. Like, I helped estimate the total addressable market for each of those opportunities. And I can tell more a little bit more about why this idea, you know, was successful or like kind of was interesting for the senior management as well. But the idea, like, okay, imagine, so that was it. And yeah, and I think the rest was history. So we then went into the product development process and yeah. Oh, wow. I just realized I've been talking for so long. Yeah,
so interesting.
Yeah, it's easier for us. We don't have to make the It's great.
I think all the different ways you can do innovation. And so having told you guys everything, right? So starting from, hey, we are a team that has lots of money to do a proof of concept with startups, to we are a team that of innovation consultants that helps internal teams innovate, to we are a venture studios that creates speedboats in a very lean way, to fourth one, which is hey, we actually have a product and budget and like we can build this thing, which is so there's a lot of ways you can do innovation. And to be honest, I feel like the best one out of those, I think could be these the Venture Studios one. Okay. Out of everything I've heard and I've seen, and I can probably explain in a bit more detail if you're interested.
Yeah, because the Venture Studios you were mentioning, each of the team members had to present 2 projects per week.
Pretty much, yeah.
And then how was the process of evaluating those ideas and deciding what to work on?
Great question. I'm glad he asked. I was like planted the seed, like, oh, if you're interested. But anyway, so the elevator pitch is the starting. Like basically any idea you have is you have to put it in as like in the clearest form possible. And clarity is king. Like and I think I've learned it the hard way. And I'll explain why. Why? Because the format or the template that we had to fill in was very concise. So like first slide is the name, quite simply. Second slide, the problem. One sentence. No more, no less. Just one clear problem. Third slide. Solution. Also, one sentence, maximum 2, right? Mm-hmm. Has to, like, it just has to click. Next one, is it useful? And you have to rate it, like you have to.
Is it useful?
I'll tell you more. Is it unique? Mm-hmm. Also, rating out of 10.
Okay.
Like you have to give an explanation, like one sentence, why it's unique, and then a rating. Then how does it make money? Out of 10. How does it grow?
Out of 10.
Out of 10. How does it become defensible? Out of 10. And of course, that means you first, of course, have to put some qualitative data, like why you think, what lever you're going to pull to make it defensible or, you know, to make money. And I can run you through an example. So one of the ideas I was proud of, but never really saw the light of day.
You can tell it to others. We can try it. We are running right out of ideas.
So let's call it, I don't remember the name, but let's call it laptop. No, cup. Let's call it cup. Okay. So problem, as a person interested in home improvements, it's very difficult to find a tradesperson I trust and do payment in a way that makes me feel protected, right? Mm-hmm. Solution, a contract, payments and mediation platform like PayPal for services. Because the interesting, I can elaborate. So then, is it useful? Yeah, and that's basically where you say how difficult is that problem to solve and how much people want to solve it. And then all I did was like, yeah, that's one of the that's probably the most stressful part of any home improvements. People hate it, quite simply. Might fill in some, you know, screenshots of like people kind of saying bad things on this home improvements website. Then how does it make money? Transactional business model. Mm-hmm. Just that one line, straight away you get it, right? Then next one. I think, is it unique? And then quite simply I say, yeah, no one else does it. And then PayPal only does it for physical goods, because when you go into mediation for services, it's a very murky area. Not impossible, but very murky area. How does it grow? I think that's when I was like, I think I was saying referral. Referral incentives. There are very few levers you can pull. How does it remain defensible? I think I just said brand. I think it actually benefits from network effects. So yeah, quite simply, by the way, things that I say might not make sense to you guys, right? But to, let's say, this room of people who are working with me, like it makes sense straight away.
No, for us, it's making sense.
I'm so glad.
Don't worry about it.
Because I was just wondering, like, am I even making?
It's making a lot of sense. Yes.
Awesome. I'm so glad. And the idea is, at a glance, people have to get it, right? And then if they like it, oh, they'll usually say, I think this is, you know, the business model is the kind of the hardest part. That's what you need to focus in your deep dive. Or they'll say, I think defensibility is not very thought out. And ultimately it will be a critique, right? Like where, you know, and quite simply, some people say, you know, and a lot of the times it would be Dean or Gary, because, you know, they're more senior, have more experience. They'll say, nah, I don't think it will work. Like, scrap it. And the idea is, yeah, like, it's very painful to get that rejection the first few times, but then you just build a thicker skin and you're like, yeah, whatever, like, next one. And a lot of the times it's like you just have to change something about your initial one based on the feedback you received. Okay. Then you go into the deep dive, and because now you have more than 2 minutes, you have all seven, you actually start basically elaborating on each of the slides. So you don't necessarily talk about the... how unique is it or how useful. Instead of it, you just say, you know, you say problem, maybe you give some evidence, you say solution, you kind of create a very like low fidelity prototype in Figma just to illustrate, because, you know, picture is worth 1,000 words, especially if it's an app screen. Then rather than unique, useful, you would actually say, you look at the opportunity, so how big the market is, then how does it make money? You'll actually do the calculations of, let's say, how you would charge your customers and what's your path to, let's say, $100 million kind of revenue. Uh-huh. Is it even achievable? Because if not, it's not interesting, quite simply. Then you look at growth, you'll actually kind of... let's say, you know, look at the possible go-to-market strategy, but not much, like just a few, because you've picked a lever and you'll say, you kind of elaborate on it. And defensibility, you might, for example, I said network effects, you might actually explain how those network effects work. In the case of that proposition, I will say, well, you know, as a customer, I want to be protected, so I'll push my tradesperson to accept a payment through this platform. So the tradesperson uses this platform, and then they're like, oh, well, you know, it's quite convenient. More people are interested in me. He's a featured tradesperson. So, like, all of a sudden, more tradespeople want to stay competitive, and they'll also join the platform. So it's like, it's almost like a flywheel, but, of course, it takes a while for any startup to get there. Yeah. But anyway, you kind of have to elaborate on it. And once that's figured out, that's when you go into... I think it's a week of like focused work by the whole team, where everybody splits up work. Like, say, hey, you're very, very great at UX research, Diana. You set up a few studies. Like, hey, Dima, you can do the prototype. Like, you know, you know, principle or something. And effectively, we divide and conquer. And by the time, like, kind of we come back together in a week later, we see if it's all cohesive, how is the response, you know, how's the prototype, is it, you know, does it look exciting, usable, and then we go to the global the global innovation team, and we just show what we have. We see, and if they are excited, and I think like Dean is just amazing at selling ideas, so yeah. In a lot of ways, if he's excited about it, it's very likely that they will be excited about it. And from then, it's cool. They're like, yeah, they give their kind of informal nod of approval. It all goes into a deck, and then it goes, like, they're formally presented, and they talk about the details of, like, yep, this is how much money we need, this is who will help us build it, and things like that. So, yeah, a very long answer to your question.
And isn't it really difficult to manage a team of 17 people right at the beginning of a project? Like, aren't there like that many things to do that 17 people can be fully working on that?
I think, good question. I think it has more to do with the fact whether you worked with these people before or not. And I'll explain, because I think... it was Gary who shared, there is like a framework as to how teams get formed, and it's like forming, norming, storming something, which means there's a lot of instability, and kind of morale is very low when you're just forming, because like, I don't know these strangers, you know, I'm supposed to be working with, can I trust them? But then norming is like, you kind of get used to each other, you know, who's like, you know, whom you can rely on, who can kind of, who, let's say, would be the go-to person if you have questions. And then storming, storming and performing. Yes, I think storming is, I don't remember what happens there, but performing is when you're like, you're onto it. Uh-huh. And yeah, I think there's a bit of like, ooh, what's happening? With right communication, and I think like Gary he kind of aced it. He really made like people okay with a little bit of uncertainty at that stage. We're like, hey guys, you know, on one hand, we have our tech team working closely with AWS to figure out the right infrastructure for this app, because it's a mobile first app. So it's built in Angular. Effectively, it's not a native app. Native app mean, you know, iOS or Android. It's just a thing you can open in your browser, but it's still, you know, it's you can access it through the mobile app. It just opens like this web view kind of thing. But because it's one of the first projects to be built in AWS, AWS is Amazon Web Services. Rather than on legacy systems, which is usually the case with a bank. So there was a lot of work by the tech team to figure out the best way to do this, because even our dev were not familiar with AWS at that point, because all they were really exposed to like the legacy systems where they had to code in Java. quite old school shit. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, for example, we, the product team and the design team, needed to figure out, we have this very open-ended question or like open-ended task, create a, you know, one-stop shop for all home needs. Where do you start? Right, and that's kind of where the product and the design come in. So on one hand, for example, I'll be doing a lot of the business case analysis. So in terms of home services, you know, you have the home buying, home improving, home ownership, all of the stages. Mm-hmm. I guess all of these pieces of the pie. So which one of them is the biggest? So, and I had to like really dig for the total addressable market for each one, and you know, it's not exact science. Sometimes you kind of have to do a bit of a guesswork based on the market research numbers you do find. But ultimately, I was like, okay, I think we have to go for home improvements as one of the first, because it has £75 billion, in total addressable market. Whereas the next one, which was, I think, home selling, is close to 25. So kind of like three times less. I was like, yeah, makes sense. So, and that's the thing, like, you kind of should be okay with making imperfect decisions. You never have all the information, but you have to try and make as much of an education decision as possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've done that. Then, for example, you know, somebody at the design team will start to create that first kind of mock-up of what it looks like. And so that by the time that, let's say, you know, the tech team figured out how to build the infrastructure, we figured out what to build first, feature-wise, that's the time where you're like, okay, let's go and do this. And that's, I think, where the Scrum Master was really useful, because Meva Vinay, like, again. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, it's like, it's a heroic effort by lots of people in the team. So she kind of helped us to work the agile way, and she kind of educated us on how to do it well. And she stayed with the team for a good 6 months, maybe a year, to like make sure that we really understood how it all works before she left. And that was the first time I actually worked in an agile way, in a sense, which is, you know, Scrum, like a framework, and how you apply agile to large organizations. And when you have those frameworks, things just flow. Not gonna lie. So back to your question, would it not be difficult if you didn't know each other? Once you know each other, easy. Like the processes, you know, there are playbooks there to like make those things work smoothly. So,
How is the speed of this like team performance in general? Is there a lot of bureaucracy on the decision making process, or how is it?
Yeah, you have to be reporting to someone all the time, or how much is the level of autonomy and flexibility and freedom?
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing, which I don't know if, you know, that was just the benefit of what kind of Steven, you know, kind of laid the foundations for. But we just had
they
so
trusted him, right?
Yeah, like we just had almost full autonomy to go about doing this thing. And I think like the guys were really pushing the fact that like, guys, we know how to do this. Just let us do our job.
Okay.
And I think a lot of course, kind of personal trust went into this, which would be like Steven, Gary, etc. And every time, you know, they had those updates, which I mean, would probably be like, I don't know, every month, maybe less often. Yeah, maybe more often. They would just say, yeah, this is what we've done. And because of how nimble our team was, we would also always do things much faster than the rest of the bank. So people were like, whoa. Yeah. But that's probably a testament of how slow things are in the bank rather than us.
Good.
Yeah. I think we were fast, but, you know, not like scale up fast, because those guys are, yeah, it was like, they take methamphetamine and shit, you know. that's like next level things. But I think, yeah, within large corporate, we were like probably the fastest out of anybody else. So that's why actually the trust only built. And whilst when we started, there were very few people who actually believed in what we were doing. So it was literally CEO and Steven. Like, that was it. I mean, maybe there were others. Like,
Steven is like God for you, no? Okay.
That's the interesting thing. Like, I don't know, because I actually haven't worked closely with the guy. So Gary Massey, my manager, was kind of direct report. But I feel like based on what I heard from Gary, it's just, thinking like he laid a lot of the groundwork. And unfortunately, he left early before he actually saw his fruits of his labor come to fruition. So now he's with Capgemini, I think, probably onto greener pastures. But anyway, sorry, what was the question?
I think you finished the question, yes.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
And can you mention like some challenges that you had during the process, and how did you solve it? How was the approach of the team when a challenge appeared?
Oh yeah, true. And that, I remember the question was about agility and speed.
Yes.
Right. I'm so sorry. yes, so speed-wise, when it came to development, we were very fast. So we operated in two-week sprints, which meant every 2 weeks we have to have some sort of deliverable on the development side. Mm-hmm. I think it would probably take us, depending on the complexity of a feature, but for example, a feature which is a few screens, takes a little bit of back-end work of connecting APIs, would probably take us one sprint. So like, from 2 weeks to 4 weeks is roughly kind of the development time. And if you also include things like unit testing, which is just making sure that, you know, those things kind of, you set up automated testing, you know, that your code doesn't break things, basically means that you'll be looking at about a month, maybe month and a half work, if like to make sure it's like perfectly done. Now, that's the development side of things. The actual bottleneck came from the business as usual processes. So the governance, the compliance. Unfortunately, because after 2008, all banks have been been hit very hard in terms of regulation. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that meant anything that the bank touches or works on has to kind of adhere to the same regulation. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure about that one, but that's what our compliance team told us.
Okay.
we never really believed them, because ultimately we were doing a prop tech product.
You didn't want to believe them.
Yeah, maybe, that's true. Because ultimately we were doing a prop tech product. It's not a fintech product.
Yeah.
But they don't care. and that meant that they almost had to scrutinize every single word, every single screen that we put in front of people, which, to be honest, like those things take like weeks of back and forth. Mm-hmm. So something that would take us, the team, like to actually develop and for like in a month would take me 2 to 3 months to get all the checks and tick boxes in the bank, which, you know, I think over time we got faster at doing, also because, you know, our compliance team, I think they figured out that like we're not really the same as everybody else in the bank, so kind of cut us some slack, but also they found a working relationship with mm-hmm. us. At first, it was like we were almost fighting. Like, you know, we were very mad at them. They were very frustrated with us. Like we almost had to have therapy, kind of like go through therapy together. Yeah, and then of course the governance. Unfortunately, as we were about to go live, I don't know how much I can even talk about it. But yeah, I think it's fine. So the cloud infrastructure is very new to the bank. Mm-hmm. No one knows how it works. Well, the governance people didn't know how to. So, and all of a sudden they were like, wait, you guys develop on cloud, right? AWS is like in cloud. Like, okay, we don't know how to control it, so pause. We need to figure out how we regulate, how we govern it within the bank. And basically what was supposed to launch, I think in February, this mm-hmm. year ended up getting launched in September this year.
Okay.
I mean, you know, like it's not like we were just sitting on our asses not doing anything. We just kept iterating on the product. And at the end, you know, the product that did end up getting launched is way more useful. Like, you know, you can order a tradesperson to come in. Which basically is an integration with a service called Local Heroes, which you just type in a job you need to do, like, I need a plumber, you know, like, and straight away you get a quote, you know, even before you made any commitments, you say, yeah, that quote works for me, which is the first in the market. No one else did it. Previously, you had to, like, find a person, text them, how much would you do this for me? That was, like, the best in class. So we did that. With Local Heroes, we also allowed you to switch utility bills, phone bills, electricity, what else? And I think internet as well, broadband. And we wrote a bunch of guides on things which we have in the works, but, you know, like we're kind of teasing interest, like, you know, things like home moving guide and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, in the end, kind of the version that did launch is a lot more impressive and more of kind of behind the vision of just being that one-stop shop. And I remember, like, when I showed you, like, wow, so there's so much to do. Well, that's because it got held up. But yeah, like, what, 8 months? 7 to 8 months. Because normally, yeah, you want to launch as soon as possible, and then iterate based on the feedback you get.
Yeah, that's actually something that I wanted to ask, because normally the process in a normal startup is that you do the fastest and shittiest MVP that you can. Yes. You get some feedback, you iterate, and you continue building. But how is the level of the level of requirements and how good the product has to be inside this kind of big corporates to be able to launch it because of their brand image and all this stuff?
Sure. And so we are comparing, let's say, Santander with like a no-name startup.
Yeah.
No. Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course it has bad things, but also I guess good things as well.
All right, so from a startup, I will have validated something using my personal funds in 2 days. And probably if I had, a developer, we would have created some, thrown something together in about 2 weeks. You know that Y Combinator says, like, if your thing takes that more than, if your MVP takes more than 4 weeks, like, cut the scope. Uh-huh. So, and I'll launch as a no name and see what happens, right? Now, that is not how it works in the large corp. So I think you kind of have to understand that between when the concept is introduced, which in the case of My Home Manager 2019, to when it actually launches, which 2022. Yeah, it's ridiculous, man. A lot of people will need to have seen it at different stages and kind of almost gave their, like, either okay or like, yeah, we're not against, because that's kind of what you're up for. You don't really want everyone to be happy with it, but you just don't want anyone to be really against it. I think that's what you're going for. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of people will have seen it. Like, some people, you know, would have seen it, like, like not looked at it for another 6 months, and then again, maybe. So that's why I'm saying, like, maybe something that was presented back in 2019 actually got to market in 2022. Not great, but it is what it is.
And for example, for Santander, wouldn't it make more sense just to build this startup completely outside the company, and if it succeeds, just acquire it? Instead of like doing the whole process inside with all the regulation and stuff.
100%. And that's ultimately says like, does my job make sense? And I part of me thinks maybe as an innovation consultant, not really. I do believe that. And that's kind of the innovator's dilemma, right? Do you invest money, time, and you know, into something that probably much more money than just acquiring a startup, you know, that have kind of gone through all the legwork to prove there is a market there. They've already established some form of a market share, and yeah, you just acquire them. And to be honest, I would probably say that. Yeah, it is the simple way to go. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to invest in innovation? I think most of the companies, what they do, they just view it as something to tell their shareholders, yeah, we care about innovation, rather than something that they take seriously. So, and that's kind of the unfortunate truth that maybe people don't speak out about. So yeah, there's a lot of bullshit in the area. And the interesting bit is like a lot of the times you get McKinsey's of the world, the Bains, to like come in and present ideas which are not novel, which, you know, probably someone in the bank has already presented. But wow, you guys are genius. Wow, amazing. That's what we do. I think the large corps never struggle with the amount of ideas, the amount of bright people that work there. What they don't sometimes have is the culture to help those people grow and succeed. Probably succeed would be the right word. Hence why, you know, people eventually churn out. I think I've been miraculously lucky to kind of see so many different types of how to do innovation, how it works and what doesn't work, and also be kind of put on a product, you know, where I've gone through the whole kind of product life cycle, really, which then, you know, resulted in more opportunities down the line. So that's why, yeah, I think I've been fortunate to experience what I've experienced. But back to the point of like, does it not make more sense to just acquire a startup? I think it does. Quite honest, like, no bullshit. Because then whatever else, you're almost like justifying, oh yeah, but it brings a better culture. Yeah. maybe. I think the best thing I found is when startups, which funny enough went through Y Combinator, like Stripe, Airbnb, they want to replicate some part of it within their corporate. And they literally create like a small team of like three people, which would normally be a product manager, designer, and a developer. Mm-hmm. And they operate in like, and they just get, you know, they get like money, like, and it's up to them to figure out what's that one thing to build in a startup way, basically. And that's a little bit like that venture studio model, but like even smaller. And I think that's more of a different situation where you had a startup which has scaled up, you know, very fast, but it kind of wants to retain some of that culture of the startup which made it great. And I think that's a much better way than kind of a large corp that, you know, been around for hundreds of years, to almost like say, you know, we reinvent itself because, I don't know, we say world's like agile and, and something else. No. I think there's still some very interesting things happening on the fringes. Like, for example, like my whole manager, I genuinely believe is if Santander doesn't mishandles it, because it can, is probably the most interesting product that came out of Santander UK in a while. Because what else can it like really pride itself on? A new current account? A new mortgage? Awesome. Like, You know what I mean? And that's the difference.
Yeah. And I think also regarding this, this process of innovation inside the big corporates. Yeah. We have some examples. For example, Samsung now have like an acceleration program. Yeah. And I think that's been great for them because they are able to control more or less what's happening, but external people are doing the things. If it succeeds, they just own it, and if not, no. Yeah. So I think that's also a really good way for big corporates to approach innovation.
Yeah, it's almost like a little bit like grooming, you know, like grooming before acquiring.
Yeah.
In the UK, I think Barclays, so another bank, tried to do that. I don't know how successful it was because I don't think many acquisitions actually came out of that.
Okay.
I genuinely believe that some startups should not be touched by the corporates until they hit product market fit and they are in a scale up stage. I think that's good for both startups and good for large corps. I'll explain, because when you're young and nimble, like, you just don't want to be dealing with some guy from a large corp telling you, oh yeah, we're so excited, and then you spend like 2 months of your development time just trying to cater to their needs. And all along, that guy never cared about, you know, what you were doing. He was just feeding you false promises, which unfortunately is the culture. And to me, it's like, just, no, don't go there. don't touch it until you're at a point where you're big enough, means, you know, you're already Series A, heading into Series B. That's when it's probably the best time. And also, that means for the founders, they will have accrued a big enough stake, or let's say, big enough interest so that in the event of acquisition, they will go home with a big and fat paycheck. And if that doesn't happen, well, probably that's not the best opportunity you went after. And that's just, you know, that's an L you have to take as a founder. So I don't think that something good can come out of grooming startups. All you end up having is lots of zombie startups, which just, you know, kind of effectively do contracting work for these big companies, which I think is one of the problems with chaebols, right? The kind of the conglomerates in Korea. At least that's what I heard. If it's an employee of Samsung, like, you have to pay them so many benefits, severance pay, etc. It's a nightmare. Versus, hey, there you go, like, startup will do anything for just your slight one. You know, like, oh yeah, you look cool, and you're like, they're already so happy just to hear that. But in fact, it actually like doesn't mean much.
So for you, product market fit means Series A, Series B?
Usually that's historically, like, on average, that's when most companies hit product market fit. In a B2B space, usually you're looking at Series B.
Okay.
Just because it just takes longer. I think to sell to companies and to have produced a scalable kind of a sales process that, you know, you can replicate. I think B2C, if you're at a Series A, you should have very strong signs of product market fit, like, you know, people raving about your product, like, absolutely loving it, you know, the metrics, like, I mean, what's it called, the monthly recurring revenue, you know, the drill. You guys interview actual entrepreneurs, ask them those questions.
And I think we got a really good idea on the benefits and the downsides of entrepreneurship for companies. But what about for the people who are actually being entrepreneurs? Because I believe that being an entrepreneur has also many benefits, like, you can do exits and many stuff. But in entrepreneurship, what are the motivations and that make people actually prefer to do that instead of doing it outside?
I think it's just, it's an overall risk tolerance and personal circumstance. For example, you know, like, when I joined, like, I've just failed a startup. Like, I was broke. I could not stomach another failure. And I needed that, like, you know. By the way, when I joined, I felt like I had such a huge case of imposter syndrome. I was 22, I was the youngest person in the team. All of my other colleagues were in the late 20s, like early 30s. And I was just like, why am I on the same level as them? Like, what were they thinking when they hired me, you know?
How old are you, by the way, now, if you can say?
So now I'm 26.
26?
Right? Yeah. So down. Okay.
Oh, come on, man.
No, yes.
I thought you were.
Okay. Yeah, dude. But like, of course, I think that experience both really formed like my confidence in myself, and I feel like I've almost got a lot of the failures and a lot of the, let's say, kind of L's whilst I was at the company, but also like, I'm trying to think, what about people that stuck around that were more senior than me? Good question. I think for them it's probably a case of a personal,
situation. Yeah.
Mm. Personal situation and also risk tolerance. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I think risk tolerance is.
Yeah, because like, yeah. Dude, it's.
And maybe self confidence.
Yeah, I think a lot of like people just, and this is again, you know, very premature assessment. Like, I haven't actually spoken to many of them about it because it's not a comfortable conversation to have. Like, hey guys, why are you not doing startups? although I've did with a few, and I think from what I've heard is, well, I have a kid or I have XYZ. And actually, one of the cool things I found from Dean Fankhauser, who's like a serial entrepreneur, he didn't stick around for long, but the time he stuck around, like, he's had such an impact on me. Like, the dude, I don't know, like, I can't call him a mentor, but like, shit, like, I've learned so much from him. But anyway, he kind of instilled that culture, like, you should always be having a side project. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, he's like, is that everything I've learned, everything I've done, everything that led to somewhat moderate success, I've done by doing things by myself. Mm-hmm. So, and I was like, oh yeah, you don't have to actually go all in from the start. And for example, yeah, whilst at Santander, I was working on a project in crypto, and you know that didn't fly. I was like, okay, well, you know, not a big shout. Like, not everything you do has to be a billion-dollar idea. Not everything flies, but it's like, you know, you can afford to take risks, but it's, you know, almost like a moderate risk before you decide to go all in. I think there's definitely some middle ground there.
Do you have also an aside project right now?
No, so because I've recently. My current side project is my daughter. She's turning 3 months old soon.
Oh, so and little.
She's an angel. And just the fact that, like, how much of a change it was to move from London to South Korea just means that, like, it's been a shocker. It's been a shock to the system. And because of that, I also had to let go of my job at Santander because of the move, which meant that I was in the market for a new opportunity, and quite gladly I got a new role, starting new soon. It's a fintech, a US fintech, so we'll see how that goes.
I think you can explain just at the end what is that project about before finishing. But just the last question about this whole topic. Do you think it's really difficult to shift from an entrepreneur position to an entrepreneur position? Like, if you think that someone that has been working as an entrepreneur has enough skills or mindset to become an entrepreneur?
Sorry, as an
intra to entrepreneur.
By the way, even I will struggle to.
Inside and entre is outside.
Okay, so from inside to outside.
The other way around as well, if you think that.
I think you'll pretty much have absolutely no issue if you're going from the outside to the inside. Mm-hmm. And that's what actually a lot of people do.
Maybe frustration, no?
I think the culture. Culture, like, man, like, I think that was one of the biggest reasons Dean left. Like, in my case, I think I could deal with that, but that's because I felt like I need to do a lot more growing up and a lot of learning in terms of how big companies work. I don't think he needed that. So for him, it was a bit like, you know, I don't gel with these people and can't deal with this bullshit. So I think culture would probably be the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are also the pros like, you know, stable paycheck. And who knows, you know, a streak of luck, you might do a very cool project, which, you know, was the case for me, but not for many of my colleagues. Like, for example, one person was in our team for 7 years, and just as she left, one of her projects got live.
Oh, no.
So something she's been working on pretty much like 7 years just only got live. So you can, you can imagine how you and I've only been there for 3 years. So I feel like, in a way, almost extremely lucky, I guess, for lack of a better word. But I think from the inside to the outside, that's the tricky bit. And that's why I kind of brought up the topic of side projects, because I think that's a good way to test the waters. And I think that's what a lot of, like, some people do, because those that don't probably will never leave, never leave the corporate world. I'm saying in absolutes, but that's my feeling.
And maybe like for a happy ending, like this project, my home manager is called, right?
Correct.
Now it's global, right? In which countries is it now?
So we've just restricted it to UK, to the UK market, and it's only available to our mortgage customers.
Okay.
Depending on success of that, we will, of course. I'm no longer in. but the plan is to make it available to all customers, not just the ones that have mortgages. And who knows? And of course, by then time, we will also start talking to teams in other
countries.
Because ultimately, like, we kind of keep talking to them anyway, but it's just more, they want to be notified when things are ready, and, you know, they just press launch, kind of. Because if you also think about it, like, some home services do not translate well, because, for example, a service like tradespeople, right, might be available in the UK market, but not in
England.
So they will need to find almost their, like, Polish version or their Spanish version, which I think there is no shortage of great startups in all of those markets, but it means that my home manager will look slightly different depending on which country you go to. We've just been, you know, the first to do that, because our team, you know, has done it. But we'll see what the future holds.
But ultimately, the point is that something actually went great, no?
Yes.
After all this long journey of
frustration. We did it.
And maybe just to finalize, you can talk a bit about what are your next position in your startup. Can you explain a bit how it's it?
Yeah. So I'm starting as a product manager at Canopy Servicing.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a B2B fintech startup. They provide effectively infrastructure for lenders or, you know, credit unions that would want to launch credit products themselves. But for them to do that, they would have to use their legacy systems and probably spend 3-4 months of development time to even get it running. We can pretty much give them the plug-and-play solution through our APIs, and something that took 3 months, maybe 6 months, depending on how your governance works, can finally be done in 2 weeks. So that's kind of the value proposition, is how much time you save people by providing a very highly customizable infrastructure to be built upon. I hope I did it right and you're not going to take my offer.
Pitching. Okay, it looks exciting. I hope you have a good time there in that company.
Oh, I truly do. Like, you know, I got charmed by their team.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the interesting bit. They actually rejected me at first. During the process back, I think in October. But like just how they dealt with the whole process and how transparent they were ahead of the interview. I mean, I just like I kept in touch, and I think around the time when I got, you know, an offer in December, I just like, hey guys, how are things? And just, you know, we kept chatting, and I was like, mm-hmm. I would love to have a second chance. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yep, we've changed our interview process, so I no longer had to do lead code, which is just a thing that, you know, developers do. I'm a product manager.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not something I've done before. so instead of that, we did it like a slightly different, like a design systems interview, which is still something that developers do, but at least, you know, it was a bit more approachable for me as a product manager. So kind of did okay there. That's why, you know, I got in and quite happy. Series A going into a Series B startup. So also, you know, future is looking bright. But then again, do you really know?
We don't know. And well, the last question that we always make to all of our interviewees is that if you could recommend any source of learning that you have, like for example, a book or a podcast or an article, whatever that you would like to recommend.
Career startup podcast.
You are right.
I'm not gonna be.
That's like cringe, keep it cringe. For granted, of course. Man.
No, actually, like you know, ahead of this interview, like I gave it a listen. I really like, was it Stan Choi? Like the I think it was your second.
Yes, second podcast. Sorry.
And then the other one, actually, the Jason Butte.
Jason Butte. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't gone further than that, and I'm not gonna lie. You know, mm-hmm. Those are long conversations.
It's already a lot that you listen to.
But you know, for anyone there, like who's interested in just doing startups and wants very high quality content, I think there is no better advice to follow than Y Combinator.
Yeah, definitely.
Those guys, like, top of the game.
Bible of entrepreneurship, yeah.
Yeah,
it's weird, because, like, you know, it's not my first rodeo, like, mm-hmm. done two failed ones. And every time I come back to it, like, it's almost like I see the same video, for example, and it just hits differently. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. So, like, keep coming back to it.
Awesome. Well, Dima, thank you so much for coming. It was a great, great talk.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed it.
It seemed like a lecture, like I learned a lot today. Yeah,
super nice, like yeah. Super interesting. Yeah. And I'm sure, like, how much did this last? Oh, a lot.
1 hour 20.
No, but it's amazing.
This is the first time, by the way, I see the actual
numbers.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Because before that, I was like looking at the bottom. It's like 4 hour 21 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, that's it. Thank you so much for again listening to this podcast, and see you next week with 2 more episodes. Bye bye.
See you.
If you want to keep updated on the Korea startup ecosystem, don't forget to follow us. And if you have any question or you would like to participate in one of our interviews, send us an email to koreastartuppodcast@gmail.com. See you next week.